All right, thank you, Yinchen, for organizing this talk. That's the title, and the work that I'm going to talk about was done with this wonderful postdoc at MIT, Zhen Bi. And we just posted a paper last week. And special thanks to Max Smetlitsky, that some of you may know. A few minutes of talking to Max clears up my head completely for about 2 weeks, till I'm confused again and have to talk to him. And to Nathi Seiberg, had a brief but very important conversation with him in November that helped us a lot. How many of you are trained in condensed matter physics? I know you're not. Everybody? So I have to apologize to you. This talk may make more sense to you than to condensed matter people. But I don't know, we'll see. Maybe it won't make any sense to anybody. It will make sense to Yinchen. I apologize to you too, because he heard almost the same talk like 4 days back. All right. So this talk will be on quantum criticality, primarily in condensed matter and field theory. And the quantum criticality is a big topic in condensed matter physics. A lot of people work on it. There's wonderful textbooks that have been written by Subir, who spends a lot of time here. Now, despite all this activity, our intuition, what kinds of continuous quantum phase transitions are possible, is extremely poor. Okay, and how to describe these weird continuous quantum phase transitions, we hardly understand. The ones that we do understand, the best, what's in the textbook, these are phase transitions between a completely trivial phase of matter and a phase of matter that's described by the Landau framework of spontaneous symmetry breaking of a global symmetry and the corresponding Landau order parameter. So in this case, the critical theory, if the transition is continuous, the critical point is described by a quantum field theory, which is written and formulated in terms of this, of a fluctuating Landau order parameter, right? So most textbook treatments of quantum criticality discuss just this, because these are the best understood cases. Now, there's many examples by now of quantum criticality that are beyond this Landau paradigm. One simple situation in which this Landau paradigm fails is if one or both of the two phases across the phase transition are described beyond, cannot be captured within the Landau framework for describing phase of matter. Right? For instance, non-Landau order can include things like topological order, can be described by some non-trivial TQFT, topological quantum field theory, in which case you don't expect an order parameter based description to capture the phase transition, right? And Rogers worked on many examples where this phase transitions, say between a symmetry broken standard looking phase with the Landau order parameter and a non-standard but symmetry preserving phase, which is described by, which has topological order, okay? And many such examples, in all such examples, we know that the standard Landau order parameter theory will not work, and it has to be supplemented by something else, or in some cases, just replaced completely. So perhaps most surprising, in this case, it's not at all surprising that the Landau theory doesn't work for the phase transition. After all, doesn't work for at least one of the two phases. This is heavy to lift. I should do that. Or maybe have an able-bodied young human being to just point as and when I require it. What, you point this way? No, this must be harder. It's better to do that. This is easier, I think. There's some elementary physics here, but I can't. Let me try this. So perhaps most surprising are situations in which there's a continuous phase transition between two phases that both can be described within the framework of Landau theory, right? And then But the transition itself, according to the rules of Landau theory, may be forbidden to be continuous. But we have many situations in which we have such Landau forbidden continuous phase transitions between Landau allowed phases of matter. Okay? We first encountered this way back, nearly 15 years back now, in an example in quantum magnetism, where there's a phase transition that appears to be, the theory allows it to be continuous, which occurs between a nail ordered state of a quantum magnet on a square lattice, Spinhoff square lattice magnet, into what's known as a valence bond solid phase. And these break completely different symmetries. This breaks spin rotation, but preserves lattice symmetries. While this preserves spin rotation, but breaks lattice translation and lattice rotation, the other set symmetries. Right? So there's two completely different order parameters. And within standard Landau rules, this phase transition cannot be second order. But it turns out that it can be. And so it's something that's beyond Landau. Right? It turns out it can be second order and is described by a weird critical theory. And Roger has done a lot of wonderful numerical work establishing the legitimacy of the field theory musings of the authors there in real concrete models with numerical calculations. So the kind of theory that emerges is what's known as a deconfined critical theory. And the field theory for the critical point is not naturally written in terms of the order parameter fields, but it's written instead in terms of weird deconfined degrees of freedom with emergent gauge interactions, though the phase on either side only have conventional confined excitations. Right? These weird excitations become the useful variables in terms of which to write the Lagrangian of the field theory, even though they're not at all the natural variables in terms of which you'll describe either phase of matter. Okay? Now there's many other proposed examples of this phenomenon in 2 plus 1 dimensions. All the examples so far are in 2 plus 1 dimensions. And in recent years, we've understood a great deal more about this kind of theory. It turns out that very similar theories emerge also for critical points between trivial and symmetry-protected topological phase of matter. Again, I'm going to assume that almost everybody has heard of these SPT phases. I know Shougang used to be here for many years. Most of you probably were not here at that time, but you were. You're here forever. Furthermore, it turns out that the theories that emerge for these phase transitions are sometimes exactly equivalent to the theories that emerge for these kinds of phase transitions, even though on the face of it, they are completely different. The phases involved are completely different. And we understand why the equivalence between these two by using various duality transformations of a kind that have been intensely studied in the last few years. That's what's known as a web of dualities. Many theories, many Lagrangians for conformal field theories turn out to describe the same conformal field theory, but from different starting points. Right? That's known as a web of dualities. And this web of dualities relates theories that emerge for this kind of transition, the theories that emerge for this kind of transition. So all that is understood, but that's not the subject of this talk, okay? So I'm going to talk about phenomena in 3 plus 1 dimensions, 3 spatial dimensions, 1 time dimension. And in the course of this work, we found a number of surprising, at least surprising to us, the two authors of this paper, surprising quantum critical phenomena for which we have no previous examples, or in some cases, very few previous examples. Right? So the first thing that I'll discuss is this phenomenon of deconfined quantum criticality in 3 space dimensions, 4 space-time dimensions, for which, at least within condensed matter physics, there were no examples before. You know, I myself spent many years thinking about it and didn't make any progress till we wrote this paper. The other phenomenon that we've long suspected was possible but didn't have any examples for is this situation where the same phase transition admits multiple universality classes. Right? So imagine you have two distinct phases, phase A and phase B, in some system. You tune some parameters, you go from phase A to phase B, then there's a phase boundary. Right? Now, along this phase boundary, one region of the phase boundary is controlled by one fixed point, right? And another region of the phase boundary is controlled by a different fixed point. Now, both parts of the phase boundary are continuous. The phase transitions are continuous, right? But nevertheless, the universality classes are different. Okay. Then, for many years, there's been a question. A lot of people have discussed this, including myself informally in conversations. No one ever could come up with a reason why this was forbidden, but we also didn't have any examples, except in disordered systems. Right? That's no exactly marginal thing. So they're not fixed lines, but fixed points. So another way to say it is that there are two distinct fixed points which have the same local operators, the same faces under massive deformations, but they are different fixed points. So we'll find that there's an infinite number of examples. We'll find an infinite number of examples in the course of this talk. Now, there's a third.
These are not dual in any real sense of the word.
They're not dual in your sense. They are dual in a condensed matter sense. So in condensed matter physics, we'd say that these two theories are weakly dual. Not in your sense, but there is a sense in which they have a lot of similarities. They descend from the same UV system. Right? In that sense, there are different descriptions of the same UV system, different descriptions that become legitimate in different portions of the phase boundary. These are totally different IR fixed points, but they descend from the same UV lattice theory. Yeah, there was a question somewhere there?
Yes.
All right, okay. There's a third phenomenon, which again, I had wondered about in the past, but had zero examples for. It's what we call an unnecessary continuous phase transition or an unnecessary quantum critical point. So here, there's a phase boundary that doesn't separate two phases from each other, but rather it just lives within a single phase. Meaning, it's like the liquid-gas phase transition. Liquids and gases are famously in the same phase. Very weird to every non-physicist, but it's an amazing thing that you learn, and one of the most amazing things that you learn in statistical mechanics, right? That the liquid and gases are the same phase. You can go around the phase boundary, but the phase transition, liquid-gas phase transition, is first order, and it terminates at a critical endpoint. Here, we'll find examples where there's a continuous phase transition which you can go around. Right? So it's totally weird. Right? So normally when we think about phase transitions, the first question we ask is, what are the two phases on either side? Now we'll find there are examples where there's just one phase, and this phase boundary really has, on general grounds, it didn't need to exist, but it does. Okay? I'll describe an example. The fourth example will be a fermionic analog of these Landau forbidden phase transitions, where we'll discuss quantum criticality between two band insulators. But the phase transition is something that's forbidden to be second order within band theory. But once you have interactions, it turns out that it becomes possible to have a second order phase transition. So it's band theory forbidden quantum criticality between two phases, either of which can be adequately described within band theory. So all this is sort of having fun and fooling around with phase transition theory. But at the end of it, based on this understanding and the intuition that we'll build up, what I'll do is to suggest a striking possible duality in your sense, in the strong field theoretic sense, of fermions, of theories with fermions and without any supersymmetry in 3+1 space-time dimension. Okay? So I'm going to, as I said, focus on theories in 3+1 dimensions. And I'm going to start by describing a very simple theory, the free fermion. the free Dirac fermion. And in fact, the only calculation that I'll sketch is for the free Dirac fermion. The methods that we'll use to analyze the more complicated theories that I'll talk about can all be illustrated in this context, right? And this calculation is worth knowing about anyway. But this same philosophy will continue for all the other phase transitions that I'll discuss. And after that, I'll go on to the theories that are of real interest in this talk. I'll talk about Yang-Mills theories with based on SU2 gauge group, massless Yang-Mills theory with some matter fields. And I'll show that these give the world's simplest and most concrete examples of this phenomenon of deconfined quantum criticality. Now, the 2 plus 1D examples that we've all spent 15 years working on, we need Roger and his fellow numericists to be able to be confident that transition is second order, these are the exponents. The theories are strongly coupled in infrared. We have no handle on them. But here, we'll find that even without Roger's help, we can be confident, which is great. And all right, I'll also discuss some generalizations. And then I'll get to this duality in 3 plus 1D. The duality will be between a non-abelian gauge theory on one side. On the other side, the proposed theory will be a free theory augmented with a gap topological quantum field theory. Now, there's a direct connection to Jaume, do I pronounce Jaume? There's a nice work by Jaume and Zohar, who's out babysitting or something right now, and Nazi Cyborg from just last year. In fact, it's their work was in 2 plus 1 dimensions, and I first heard about it when Zohar was visiting MIT last fall. And while we were doing this work, at some point we ran into some problem. But then I was inspired by your work to say maybe the same kind of thing as you found in 2 plus 1D gets around our problem, and we looked for such a fix, and indeed we found it. Okay. All right, so let's start the story by thinking about the free Dirac fermion in 3 plus 1 dimensions. Right? So everyone has seen the Lagrangian, psi bar minus id slash psi. Psi got fixed notation, psi is a 4-component fermion. Okay? And I've not added a mass term in the Lagrangian, but that's part of the dot, dot, dot. Right? I'm going to allow myself the freedom to add a mass term and study the phase diagram as a function of the mass. Okay? Now, I'm also going to allow myself to introduce a background probe gauge field to probe the dynamics of the system. I'll introduce a gauge field capital A. It's a background U1 gauge field. Again, since you're here, I'll say that it's a spin C connection. Oh, good. I've learned to say this in the last 2 years. Now I'm showing off. It's usually just to protect my back. You know, in case someone in the audience, I assume all string theorists think like this, right? That someone will say, do you mean a U1 gauge field or a spin C connection? I know how to answer them. It's a spin C connection. But if not, most of you probably don't know what it is, so just ignore this comment. All right. So we'll couple this fermion to this capital A gauge field. By background gauge field, it means it's a probe of the system. It's not something that you integrate over in a path integral, right? What you do is to calculate the partition function of the theory as function of the arbitrary configurations of this background gauge field, right? It's just a probe of the system. It's not part of the dynamics of the system. Now, it turns out also to really understand all the physical properties of the system, we shouldn't just couple it to this background U1 gauge field. We should also, that will give me the electrical response of the system, right? So this has the Dirac fermions as an electric charge. Can ask about electrical transport properties and at the boundary and the bulk, blah, blah, blah. But I may also be interested in thermal effects, right? Heat transport, thermopower, blah, 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 all those kinds of things. Now, for that, the right analogous quantity is to change the metric in the system. Right? So Kenneth Smadow physicists might know some, you guys are probably all too young, even you, Roger. There's a famous paper from the 1960s by Luttinger explaining how to discuss thermal transport and other things in Kenneth Smadow systems by turning on a metric and looking at the response of the system to a metric. Right? So in that spirit, we'll also allow ourselves to place the system on an arbitrary, smooth, oriented space-time manifold with some metric g. Okay? Now, this oriented is for simplicity, and also because that's all I know how to do. And we'll be able to answer all questions without worrying about unoriented manifolds. So the symmetries of this Dirac fermion theory are that there is a global U1 symmetry associated with charge conservation, and there's a time reversal symmetry. Now, there's also other discrete symmetries. There's parity and there's charge conjugation. But these are the two main symmetries that will be important, what I'm going to say. Now, with this choice of time reversal, the electric charge is odd under time reversal. So that's a non-standard choice. The most standard choice say that the electric charge is even under time reversal. But, you know, you can toggle between the two by combining time reversal with charge conjugation. Right? So I think field theorists usually refer to this as CT instead of T, but fine, you know. Right. So that's the generic symmetry of this model in the presence of a non-zero mass term. We'll discuss the massless point, which is a special point later. So what's the phase diagram of the system? Let's try and understand this very simple theory, see how to interpret it as a quantum critical point. Okay? Now, as the sign of the mass has changed, there is a phase transition in the theory. For either sign of mass, the free Dirac fermion is massive once you have a mass. But at the massless point, it has gapless excitations, right? So there's some sort of criticality there, right? So what's the difference between the two signs of mass? Okay, so in the presence of time reversal symmetry, it turns out that there's a big difference. So one of these is a trivial insulator of these fermions, and the other is a topological insulator of these fermions, okay? So let's see how to understand this difference. Now, there's a very simple, very physical way to understand the difference between these two phases, which is to do the following. Suppose instead of having a uniform mass, I consider a mass that's spatially varying, and I consider a domain wall where the mass changes from positive sign on the right to negative sign on the left. Right? The domain wall defines a 2+1 dimensional theory. And I can, just by solving the Dirac equation, I can understand the properties of the domain wall. Now, this is a simple calculation. It's a graduate quantum mechanics calculation, which has been done thousands of times. And right at that domain wall, where the mass changes sign, when you solve the Dirac equation, what you find is that there's a single Dirac cone that's localized at this domain wall. So that tells you that if one phase for one sign of mass is considered to be a trivial insulator, the other sign for the other phase for the other sign of mass is a topological insulator. Right? The TI boundary famously has this odd number of Dirac cones. Okay? So that description is very physical. It's how most condensed matter people think about it. But it's not going to be useful for my purposes. Right? It turns out that this physical way of thinking about it, you can only go that far, it's not powerful enough, right? There's a more formal way of thinking about this difference, which when we generalize the theory will turn out to be very powerful. And that's what I want to talk about in the next slide, right? So formally, the way to distinguish between these two phases is that when I turn on these background probe U1 gauge fields and the metric, the topological insulator has a theta term in the response at theta equals pi, while the trivial insulator has a theta term at theta equals zero. So we want to derive this change of theta term when you change the sign of the mass. Okay? So let's derive that change. So I'm only going to sketch the derivation. So let's do the following. Let's take our Dirac fermion theory and put it on a compact smooth oriented manifold and calculate the partition function by doing the path integral. Right? It's a free theory. And so the partition function is a determinant of whatever operator sits between psi bar and psi. And in this case, it's this covariant derivative plus m, the determinant of that operator. And now the operator D is anti-Hermitian, and so its eigenvalues are pure imaginary. And so we can write it as I times lambda I. And so the determinant is a product over these eigenvalues. Okay? Yes, thank you. But I think the audience is far too sophisticated to get confused by it. All right. Now the ratio, what we are interested in is the ratio of the partition functions, right? Because which sign of mass is topological, which sign is trivial, that's only determined by whatever UV stuff we put into the theory, right? What's more important is the change of the phase. For that, let's just calculate the ratio, right? When you take the ratio, all the dynamical information about the theory, the unimportant dynamical information is thrown away, and only the topological distinction survives. Okay, so this ratio is a product, there's this product divided by this product. The only thing that's changed is the sign of the mass. Now, furthermore, this operator minus ID is just minus I gamma mu d mu plus the gauge fields. That operator is the, it's the Dirac operator for a mass, it's the massless Dirac operator. So there's a gamma 5 matrix that anti-commutes with this operator, which tells you that all non-zero eigenvalues come in pairs. For each lambda I, there's a minus lambda I, unless lambda I is zero. Right? So using that, you can show that all non-zero eigenvalues cancel from this ratio. Okay? And the only things that remain are zero eigenvalues. Right? Now, when m is zero, when lambda I is zero, the m also cancels, and you just get a minus sign for each zero mode. Right? So this ratio of partition functions is minus one to the number of zero modes. Right? Now, zero modes come with fixed helicity, meaning fixed eigenvalues of gamma 5, so which can be plus 1 or minus 1. And then, the total number of zero modes is has some number of positive helicity modes and some number of negative helicity modes, n plus plus n minus. Now, that's the same as, minus 1 to the n plus plus n minus is equal to minus 1 to the n plus minus n minus. And this difference in the number of zero modes of opposite helicity is a topological invariant, and it's known as the index of this Dirac operator. Okay? And then there's a beautiful theorem that you can look up in some standard textbook, which tells you that this index of the Dirac operator is exactly equal to things like F wedge F, which if you plug this in here, you get precisely the right theta term for the topological insulator relative to the trivial insulator, right? So the point is that this ratio of partition functions, first of all, it's a lot easier to calculate than the partition function itself. Second of all, the ratio is a topological quantity. And the only question is which topological quantity is it? So topological things are a lot easier to compute, right? So anyway, so there's this fancy way of deriving something that we all know just by solving the Dirac equation. Right? But this fancy way is what will be powerful when we generalize the theory.
Is there a simple way of doing it? I'm sure you know that you're going to start with negative mass here and positive mass here, and then just do a kind of rotation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
One side so that both have same mass, and you want to introduce a theta term on half of the space.
Exactly.
Is just a standard chiral anomaly?
That's a standard chiral anomaly. So that's another way to think about it. But this way, it turns out, is the way that's going to be most powerful for the applications to more complicated theories, okay? We don't want to think about spatially varying things. This way, you just do calculations in uniform, with uniform mass. Okay, now let me comment on the massless point, right? Now, the massless Dirac theory has more symmetries than the massive case. For instance, I think a lot of condensed matter physicists by now know that a single four-component massless Dirac fermion can be thought of as two Weyl fermions, as this Weyl semi-metal that people have been writing papers on. Now, this massless theory For instance, you can do a chiral rotation of the two wild fermions, rotate the two wilds into each other. There's also the difference in the number of wild fermions, just known as an axial charge. So we'll regard all these extra symmetries as emergent symmetries of the critical point. They survive in the infrared when weak interactions are added to the Maastricht point. But they're not really symmetries at a generic point in the phase diagram, right? So we'll just regard these emergent symmetries. And because these are emergent symmetries, they could be anomalous. There's something called Nethoft anomaly. What it really means is that to regularize the theory while preserving these symmetries in a natural way, you have to think about this theory as living at the boundary of a 4+1-dimensional SPT phase. Okay? So I'll use the word Nethoft anomalies often. For Kenneth Spader people, that's what it means. All right, so let's now generalize this story a little bit. Let's take n free Dirac fermions, equivalently 2n free Meyer-Nav fermions, with global symmetry SO2n cross time reversal. We can repeat the same exercise, and if the m less than zero theory is trivial, then the m greater than zero theory will have a theta term for the background, for a background gauge field that couples the symmetry, namely SO2n gauge field. Okay? This means that the Maastricht point should be interpreted as a quantum critical point between a trivial and topological phase of fermions with this symmetry. Right? So this theory is, of course, a standard theory. All that we are adding now is the interpretation as a quantum critical point. These are just free theories. Okay, so now let's move on to consider more complex examples. It's more complex, but still, the theory itself should be familiar to every student of quantum field theory. Because these are theories that are written in every textbook on quantum field theory. If you've taken the full set of quantum field theory courses in grad school, right? I mean, nothing much more advanced than what's there in Zigzon and Zuber. Right? So let's consider SU2 gauge theory with coupled to NF flavors of fermionic matter fields. Right, that's what I'm going to talk about. So there's two distinct cases that I'll talk about. One is the situation where the matter fields are in the fundamental representation of SU2, namely the spin-half representation. And the other is where the matter fields are in the adjoint representation of SU2. Now, these are very different theories. They're often discussed when you do perturbative calculations as though they're the very similar theory, just change the representation. But they are very, very different theories for reasons that I'll, you know, they're very, very different theories even in the UV, right? For reasons that I'll describe as we go along. Okay, so let's start with this theory. So this is a standard Lagrangian, right? Everyone who's taken field theory must have seen this Lagrangian. So fermions coupled to an SU2 gauge field, possibly in the presence of a mass and with some Yang-Mills trace F mu nu squared dynamics. Now, the first comment about this very familiar theory is that this is actually a theory of bosons. Okay? So let me explain why that is true. Right? And this point of view, that the statement that this is a theory of bosons is actually very, very natural for a condensed matter physicist. I've found that it's also natural for several, but not all, high-energy physicists. You're the only person that I know in this audience who is from high energy. All right, so let me explain why this is a theory of bosons. You know, the Lagrangian is written in terms of fermion fields, so there are fermions in the Lagrangian, but having fields in the Lagrangian that have Fermi statistics doesn't mean anything, right? Lagrangian is just some symbol, right? Now, all local operators in this theory, you know, there are baryons that you can make in this theory, color singlets. But the baryons, because it's SU2, are made of bilinears of the fermions. So the baryons are all bosons, right? There are mesons, and mesons are always bosons, right? So all local operators in this theory are bosons. So from that point of view, this is really a theory of some system of bosons, okay? It should be contrasted with, say, SU3 gauge theory, you know, standard QCD, where the proton, which is a baryon, is a fermion, right? So SU NC with NC even and NC odd describe very different physical systems. Okay. Now with NF flavors, one can show that the theory has global symmetry, which is some weird global symmetry. It's SPNF mod Z2. This is the massive theory. The symmetry is the massless theory. I always view as emergent symmetry. This is the massive theory. At some generic point in the phase diagram, this is the symmetry, plus charge conjugation, parity, blah, blah, blah. Now, the point of view with which we'll develop an interpretation of this theory is that we'll view this gauge theory as the infrared description, or rather the mid-infrared description, some intermediate scale description of some UV system of interacting gauge invariant bosons with this global symmetry. So again, this point of view is the opposite of what's standard in at least older high energy textbooks. Older high energy textbooks would say, look, this theory is a theory of quarks, but in the infrared, it becomes a theory of baryons and mesons, right? Here we're going to say that the UV theory is a theory of baryons and mesons, and the quarks emerge as some intermediate scale description. And then eventually at low energy scales, they may survive, or they may again get rebound into baryons. Anything may happen, right? But the fundamental objects are the baryons, and the quarks are emergent objects. The opposite story from at least field theory textbooks that were written, that I read when I was an undergrad or grad student. Okay?
Is that just because this is a Dirac type mass? No, it
doesn't depend what I put in this Lagrangian. It's determined by the field content. Oh. Right? So with this field content, psi is not gauge invariant, and the only local operators that are gauge invariant are these guys, right, which are all bosons. So there's no gauge invariant local operator that's a fermion, right, that has half odd integer spin under rotations. So in that sense, it's a theory of bosons. Okay, so what I want to do is to interpret this theory. Okay, so there are almost no new calculations to do. Right? This is such a standard theory. What new thing can one have to say? It's mostly about interpretation. So again, from old field theory books, we know the infrared properties of this, the qualitative infrared properties of this class of field theories as function of NF. SU2 theory with NF flavors, NF is large enough, the theory flows to weak coupling in the infrared. It flows to zero coupling. In fact, the Yang-Mills coupling flows to zero. Okay. Now, if NF is small enough, that's more like standard QCD. The theory is believed with a lot of confidence to be confining. And it's massive, and at the massless, even at the mass, the bare quark mass is zero, it becomes massive, but low energy and whatever symmetry is there is broken. And for intermediate values of NF, it's believed to flow to a conformal field theory, an interacting conformal field theory, for which one has perturbative control just below this critical value of NF, at which you lose asymptotic freedom. And those are known as the Banks-Zaks theories. The lower end of the conformal window is a matter of tremendous debate in the lattice gauge community, but everyone believes there is a lower end, okay? All right, so these theories are interesting. They're strongly interacting CFTs in four dimensions and 3+1D, but I want to keep things simple, so I just want to focus on these theories, which are IR-free, and which usually, at least again, when I was an undergrad, were deemed to be boring theories. No, it's IR-free, what's there? As we'll see, from our point of view, they're actually pretty cool. So the question that I'm going to ask is, look, we already agreed that this describes some system of bosons with some global symmetry, right? Now, in the IR, if NF is big enough, it becomes a free theory, where there's free fermions in the IR. Now, what is the place of this theory in the phase diagram of the original boson system, right? It seems like we have emergent fermions, which are free in the infrared. Now, where do they appear in the phase diagram, okay? So the question is, what kind of criticality do these theories describe? Okay, so let's answer that question. So the way to answer it, that just as I did for the free Dirac fermion, let's turn on a mass and see what we get. Okay? Now here comes the first interesting observation. Totally obvious, but interesting. I hadn't realized it, you know, all these years that I've known ever since then. So let's look at the renormalization group flow structure as a function of the two coupling constants, Yang-Mills coupling G and the Dirac mass M. Right? Along this axis, it flows to zero. Right? That's the statement that I just described. Now along this axis, if G is zero and I turn on a mass, that's a relevant coupling in the infrared. As I go to the infrared, it grows. Right? Now, so if I'm somewhere here, G is initially going to flow to very small values. But then, once the system realizes that there's a mass to the fermions, it's going to be described below that mass scale. The effective action for the gauge field is that of pure SU2 gauge theory. Right? Pure SU2 gauge theory is strongly coupled, right, in the infrared. So the coupling constant, which initially was going to zero, turns around and starts going back up. And this happens on either side. Okay? So what this means is that this weakly coupled massless fixed point separates two strongly coupled faces from each other. Right? So Roger will recognize these kinds of Orgy flows from 2 plus 1D theories. So let's ask, what's the difference between the two massive faces? Right? So we have two massive faces, one on either side. What's the difference between these two? Okay? Both of them are trivial, almost. There's one refinement that you, of course, know very well about, but I'll make the connection in the next slide. Okay? So let's take the M less than zero side to be a trivial symmetric gap phase, with, as we say in condensed matter, with short range entanglement, everything. Okay? The question is then, what changes when you go to M bigger than zero? Now, this dynamical SU2 gauge field has an induced action from integrating out the fermions, which, because the system is time reversal symmetric, it's severely constrained at long wavelengths. It can only have the Yang-Mills term and possibly a theta term. Right? But the theta term, because the system is time reversal invariant, is quantized. The theta is quantized to be a multiple of pi. Okay? And you can fix theta through simple calculations, and it's nf times pi. Now, if nf is odd, this is a very interesting theory. It's SU2 gauge theory at theta equals pi. People still don't know what happens at strong coupling. And I don't know if you were, but Zohar and others have written papers as recently as last year suggesting interesting fates for this theory in the infrared. But I don't want to talk about theories I don't know anything about. I want to restrict myself to theories I know everything about and just reinterpret them, right? So to keep things simple, let's keep NF even. So we get standard SU2 gauge theory. And then the expectation is that it goes into a trivial symmetric gap phase, right? With short range entanglement, everything. Unlike here, where it probably goes to a long range entangled phase or something else, or a symmetry broken phase. But here, nothing interesting happens, apparently. So both phases, both massive phases are trivial, but they could differ as SPT phases, right? In terms of the response to the background gauge field that couples the global symmetry.
So that's SPT protected by SPNF?
Exactly, SPNF mode Z2 cross time reversal.
So that's the minimal symmetry to protect it,
or? No, so it turns out
It depends on
the specific value of NF. But a direct phase transition is protected by that full symmetry. You can have that phase, but protected by smaller symmetries. But if you don't have the full symmetry, it won't have a direct phase transition. So the massless point is deconfined, though both phases are confined. Right? In both phases, the excitations at low energies only have baryons, you know, which are bosons, and mesons, which are bosons. Maybe glue balls, everything is a boson. But at the massless point, you have free fermions and free bosons. Right? And everything is under control here, so we don't need you, Roger. But the theories are weird, right? From a condensed matter point of view.
small question. So we're looking at large NF theories. These theta responses exact for any NF, or is
it? It's exact for any NF.
So if you're looking at large NF, should matter whether you have even or odd NF, right?
But it does, right? Because there's some topological thing. It does matter whether it's even a rod, right? So it's not uniform. So it turns out that the method of calculation of the distinction between the two phases is the same as before. We construct this theory in some... basically, what we want to do is to look for a theta term for gauge fields that couple... for background gauge fields that couple to the existing global symmetry of the system. And it turns out, so this is a strongly coupled gauge theory, right? SU2 gauge theory, in the presence of massive fermions, it's strongly coupled. We, of course, don't know how to calculate the partition function. But that's not the question we want to answer. We only want to answer, what's the difference between the phases for the two signs of mass? So the only thing we need to calculate is the ratio of partition functions for the two signs of mass. And this is a calculation, you know, humankind can easily do, relatively easily do. And when you do that, you find that there's distinct theta terms for the background gauge field, which depends on the value of NF over 2 mod 4. So they correspond to distinct SPT phases. Okay? So that's it. We've understood what role this fixed point has in the phase diagram of the boson system. It's a deconfined quantum critical point that separates trivial and SPT phases of bosons with this symmetry and parity and so on.
What has to do with the instanton numbers and SPN or something like that?
Exactly. How they're related to the various, there's discrete theta terms that depend on W2 and W4. All right. I'm running out of time, but let me say this anyway. Now, this game can be played with any gauge theory. We're always only going to do trivial things. We're always going to look at, you know, IR-free theories so far. So we can generalize it to SUNC, but let me generalize it to SPNC gauge theories. Now, the reason to take this particular generalization is that the global symmetry of this system doesn't depend on the value of NC. It only depends on the value of NF. So these theories, for every value of NC, they describe physical boson systems with the same symmetry, right? And then by doing the same kind of calculation of the induced theta term for the background gauge fields, we can obtain, by changing the value of NC, for the same phase transition between trivial and SPT phases of the same boson system, we can obtain, realize that transition in many of these theories with different values of NC. But since the theories are IR-free, you know, different values of NC are clearly sharply distinct from each other. The number of emergent free fermions is different. Number of emergent gauge bosons is different. You know, the A coefficient is different. You know, everything is different, right? So these are examples where it's the same gap state of bosons, the same SPT phase of bosons, but there's different universality classes, right? So I already mentioned this, and this can lead to a lot of confusion, so let me quickly jump to
the part. Is the critical point also IR-free?
No, it won't be, or maybe it will be, I'm not sure. You should think about this as something where you have an additional Higgs field. Let's say this was described by SP4, and this was SP2 and SP1, right? This is SU2 and this is like SO5. But then you need an additional Higgs field. That Higgs is SP2 to SP1. And that Higgs field becomes massless here. Right? So I don't know what that theory does. Now, in considering this class of theories, there's this phenomenon that we encounter of unnecessary quantum phase transitions. It turns out that if NF is big enough, but NC and NF are both 0 mod 4, then the induced theta term for the background gauge field is trivial in this ratio of partition functions, which means the ratio of partition functions for the two signs of mass is 1. So the two faces are identical to each other, which means that this phase boundary, which has free fermions and free bosons and so on, in a system that microscopically is a system of bosons, perhaps on a lattice, there is this emergent quantum criticality within the same phase. So you can go around it by tuning parameters in the UV boson system. So we found this initially through these very, very weird examples, but then this seemed too interesting for it to be only described in weird gauge theory examples. So then we looked for it and we found much simpler examples which can be constructed without any emergent gauge fields. Right? So it looks like there's many examples of this phenomenon.
So what type of parameters do you have to tune in order to go around? Like, do you have anything in mind?
In these theories, in the UV boson system, we don't know what parameters. We don't even know what parameters are needed to put it here, right? But in these theories, we have a better idea because here there's no emergent gauge fields. Whatever microscopic UV degrees of freedom you see are the same as the IR degrees of freedom. So here I can give you a story.
Can I ask you something about the previous slide?
Yeah.
So it seems that those two different universality classes are parameterized by NC.
That's right, yeah. So there's infinite number.
Is this generic as well for standard quantum phase transitions when you generalize, say, spin group 2?
No, that we've looked for these kinds of examples for more than 10 years and we've never found one till now. We also couldn't see a reason why they can't exist. So it's, you know, I think everybody expected that there would be examples, but we just didn't have any.
Yeah, I guess my questions comes from, if you have a system of itinerant electrons and you have a quantum phase transition, mm-hmm. generalized to SUN, usually your critical exponents depend on.
Sure, on exactly, on yeah. N, right? That's right, yeah.
So that's why.
No, the exponents here will depend on which NC I have.
Yeah, definitely. So
what right? But the faces are the same. They describe the same physical system and the same phase transition in the same physical system. But they're different fixed points and they'll have different exponents.
Of course, you may imagine you just add some very massive scalar to one of those.
Yeah.
That you would say that in the same words that this is.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right. So this Higgs field that I talked about,
yeah.
Just add it with the mass. So in that theory, once, you know, the mass is m squared is positive, you may be here. M squared is negative, you may be here. Okay, so in the remaining time, let me move on to these adjoint theories with adjoint fermions. For the SU2 case, that means that these fermions are triplets under SU2, right? Now, unlike in the previous example with fundamental fermions, here there are local operators that are fermions, right? So there's a baryon like this, for instance, using the epsilon symbol of SU2, right? Which is a fermion, right? So this describes the system of fermions, okay? As we'll see in a minute, from our point of view, coming from condensed matter, it's important to supplement this theory by adding a very heavy spectator matter field, Z, in the fundamental representation. Right? So really the theory will assume that there's a very, very heavy boson that also exists in the theory, which transforms in the fundamental representation of SU2, but the light degrees of freedom all transform in the adjoint. Okay? Now the global symmetry, so I won't explain it, but it's easy to analyze the global symmetry at a generic for a generic mass. It's SO2NF cross time reversal. And we'll view this gauge theory just like before. Here we'll view it as the mid-infrared description of some UV system of fermions with this global symmetry. Okay. So let me make some remarks on this theory. Now, at the massless point, the conformal window occurs at much lower NF than with fundamental matter. Right? Fundamental matter, the NF has to be bigger than 11 for C2. But for a joint matter, the critical NF above which the theory becomes infrared free. And NF I'm always going to use as counting the number of Dirac fermions. Right? It turns out it's bigger than or equal to 3. And the other property of this theory is that, so why do I need these fundamental scalars? Right? If I did not have them, the theory has electric strings in the fundamental representation which can never break. There's no sources for these electric strings. So which means that the theory doesn't just have particle excitations, it has gauge invariant objects which are loops, right? So that means that it can never arise from a UV system with a tensor product Hilbert space, right? Of the kind that we are familiar with in condensed matter, right? Now, so that's why whenever this theory arises in a condensed matter system, it has to arise in a situation where these electric strings can break. So we assume that this very heavy fundamental scalar somewhere in the theory, but they don't play a role directly in the low energy dynamics. We might think they don't play a role in the low energy dynamics. We'll see that that changes. Now, there's a nice formal way of describing this by Davide, who's at PI. So high energy theorists came up with this term where they say that any theory that has unbreakable strings like this has a one-form symmetry. It's a generalization of standard symmetries. Now, there's a large NF story where the theory is infrared free, which is very similar to the story I had with fundamental matter. So close to zero coupling at the massless point, but the massive phases are both confined, and there's a deconfined critical point now in the fermionic system. And again, the two phases differ by one being SPT and the other being trivial. But an important subtlety, precisely which SPT you get here, depends on the symmetry that you assign to these spectator bosons, right? This again is a phenomenon that I learned this morning that Choma, getting better? and Zohar have encountered in their works. It's something that in condensed matter we realize that is actually quite common as well. And these give you interesting theories, but Chen, can I take a few more minutes or you want me to finish?
Sure.
Hold it. Just a few more minutes. So the large NF story is very simple, very straightforward to analyze, except for this subtlety, which can be analyzed as well.
So the point here in that we're discussing, so there's some mixed anomaly that depends on the choice of this expectator scalar. When you said the SPT phase depends on the expectator scalar.
Right. So it's
controlled by some anomaly. Right?
The boundary of the SPT has an anomaly. So the 2+1D boundary,
yes.
The precise time reversal anomaly of the theory depends on which choice we make for the spectator boson.
It's
exactly the same story. Yeah. All right. So what I want to do in extra time is
there's something weird philosophically about this. I mean, you usually teach our students that anomalies have to do with deep infrared things, because essentially anomalies are things that are drawn out by local counter terms.
Yeah.
Yeah. Heavy particles. Here we're saying that we have an anomaly.
Right, but
exact value depends on some choice in the UV.
Right, but these are gauge charged particles.
Yes.
So that can, I think, change the story. At least that's how it works. If these were local particles, then you add some gap local particles, it's not going to change
the number.
But they carry dynamical gauge charge, right? If they could be created locally, that I think is a different story. Okay, so in this extra time, I want to talk about a theory whose infrared dynamics we don't actually know, right? A theory that's not, at least naively, free in the infrared, but it's a very interesting and important theory in both condensed matter and in high energy physics. So I want to talk about NF equals 1. That is one Dirac fermion in that joint representation coupled with an SU2 gauge field. Okay? So this theory is important in condensed matter. You know, it's a familiar theory in condensed matter because, as I said, we have to regard this theory as the intermediate scale description of some UV system of electrons. And that UV system of electrons, NFS1, has symmetry U1 cross T. Okay? So this is a very familiar system in condensed matter in band theory. It's what's known as a class A3 topological insulator. It appears in many, many different contexts. Many of us have spent a lot of time studying this system. Okay. Now, in the high energy literature, the gauge theory is also a very, very important theory. So I made this slide several days back. And I called it a sector of a very famous theory, the so-called N equals 2 Seiberg-Witten theory. I learned today that I should not call it sector, but rather should call it deformation.
Right.
But for whatever reason, there have been a number of recent papers on this NF equals 1 theory. Two are from people trained in high energy, and this third is by us. We don't know any high energy physics. I couldn't tell from reading the papers why they were motivated to consider this theory now as opposed to 20 years back, right? But for whatever reason, this theory has become a much studied theory the last few months. So what do we know about this theory? At the master's point, it's been studied through numerics, through Monte Carlo. On lattice gauge theory, there's some evidence that it may be conformal, but it's not conclusive. Now, if M is not zero, but large, we expect confined symmetry-preserving phases, and there's no induced theta term, the dynamical gauge. It's very much like the older story that I've been telling you about the rest of the talk. So, because this point is asymptotically free, the massless point, we don't know what happens if we turn on a small mass, right? Because the theory is strongly coupled in the gauge theory description in the infrared. So we can't confidently say that this small mass theory is the same as the large mass theory. But at large mass of either sign, we know we get a trivial insulator, right? Now, if we choose M less than zero to be the totally trivial insulator, we can ask whether the M greater than zero is a topological insulator, right? And that question is easy to answer by calculating the ratio of partition functions up to one subtlety. Right? Now, to understand that, we have to know what are the possible SPT phases with this symmetry. Unfortunately, we solved that problem a few years back, since confirmed by very distinguished mathematicians. Right? So we really know what the phases are. They have this classification by this Z8 cross Z2. By calculating the ratio of partition functions, we know we can easily figure out that for m greater than zero, the phase that you get, the phase is labeled by a number k that lives in Z8 and number s that lives in Z2. It's easy to see by doing this calculation that the m bigger than zero phase has s equals zero and k is odd, right? Now, but deciding which value of odd k it is not possible directly because that's related to the time reversal anomaly of the boundary theory. And that in turn depends on the time reversal implementation on these heavy bosons, right? Now, if we choose this heavy boson to be a Cramer's doublet, then we get the most elementary topological insulator, which has k equals minus 1, right? So then we go from the most elementary topological insulator to the most trivial insulator through some sequence of evolution, right? Which is interesting. So what the gauge theory gives us is one possible evolution between the trivial insulator and the most elementary topological insulator, right? As you change the sign of mass. Now I started the talk by giving you another possible evolution between these same two limits. That's the evolution in free fermion theory. Right? Free Dirac fermions will have this phase transition with the massless Dirac fermion sitting right in the middle. So the natural question to ask is, are they the same or are they different? Right? So could gauge theory and the free fermion descriptions be the same? Right? Now the two massless theories have the same local operators because they have, you know, intermediate scale descriptions of the same UV system of fermions with U1 cross time reversal symmetry. And that's I'll show on the next slide. They have almost the same ordinary global symmetries. So there's a wild thing that you can dream about. Perhaps the massless theories are the same in the infrared. Right? But then on this side, we know exactly what it is. It's just a free massless Dirac fermion. So on this side, maybe it's just a free massless Dirac fermion. Right? Let's examine that possibility. So how should we tell? Right? Now, it's a strongly coupled theory, so we don't really have any tools to tell. But there's some checks that you have to make, right, before even suggesting something like that. You have to check that all the emergent symmetries and their anomalies match at the massless point, right? And must include both ordinary global symmetries and this one-form global symmetry that I talked about, the fact that there are loops in the theory and the anomalies of that one-form global symmetry. So let me rush through these remaining parts because I suspect I'll lose the condensed matter audience, and you already know this anyway. So let me rush through this. Right? Now let's examine the emergent symmetries on both sides. Now the single massless free Dirac fermion, let's ask about its emergent symmetry at the massless point. I said it has extra symmetry earlier, right? But let's just understand what it is. So there's two wild fermions, and you can do an SU2 rotation of these two wild fermions. That's this SU2. Also, the difference in the number of wild fermions, that's this so-called axial symmetry. That's the U1. And it turns out you had to mod it out by Z2. And this symmetry has many anomalies. There's the famous chiral anomaly for U1. There's also another famous, perhaps not in the condensed matter literature, anomaly for the SU2 known as the Witten anomaly. And then there's various discrete symmetries that won't play a big role, what I'm going to say. Okay? So all this structure has to be matched by the SU2 gauge theory if we are to claim that this duality is possible. Okay? So what are the emergent symmetries of this theory in the UV? We don't know. These symmetries may be further enhanced than IR, but in the UV Lagrangian, so the first statement is that the axial symmetry is reduced by quantum effects, by instantons, from U1 to Z8. It has to do with the fact that there's an SU2 gauge field in the theory. I won't explain that, but if anyone wants, you understand this, of course. Anyone else wants to know, ask me sometime the rest of the week. And the emergent ordinary symmetry is SU2 cross Z8 mod Z2, plus this extra one-form symmetry that I talked about. Okay. Now, if we compare with the free massless Dirac fermion, as far as the ordinary symmetry is concerned, the Z8 is replaced by U1, right? And the free Dirac fermion doesn't have any one-form symmetry. Now, here comes a very cool observation, which is very encouraging observation, that it turns out that all the zero-form symmetries and anomalies of this theory can be matched by the free Dirac fermion if we simply assume that the Z8 is dynamically enhanced to U1 in the infrared, which could very well happen. Right? In the free Dirac theory, if I try to break the U1 to Z8, that perturbation is irrelevant. So it's why not, right? That the fact that you can match all the anomalies, and it's not totally trivial because it turns out that the free Dirac fermion, the massless Dirac fermion, must be assigned an axial charge of 3 for this anomaly matching to work. But why not? So you can match these anomalies, right? So going back to these checks, this is the good news. If Z8 is dynamically enhanced to U1 in the infrared, then the free Dirac fermion can exactly match the zero-form symmetries and the anomalies. Right? This SU2 cross U1 mod Z2, SU2 cross Z8 mod Z2, and its anomalies can all be matched. But that's not the end of the story. There's a very nice paper that appeared a couple of months back by Cordova and Dumitrescu that discussed all the anomalies of this theory, and they pointed out that there are extra anomalies involving the one-form symmetry. In particular, there's a mixed anomaly with Z8 and with gravity. And this has no analog in the free Dirac theory, because the free Dirac theory doesn't have any one-form symmetry. Right? So this tells you that the one-form symmetry must play a crucial role, and the free Dirac theory can't be the end of the story, right? So this paper, the results in this paper give a direct answer to this question, and the answer is no. Okay. So this theory cannot just flow to the free Masters Dirac formula. So the question is, you know, given that as far as zero form symmetries in the phase diagram is concerned, free Dirac theory is so good. The question we were led to ask ourselves is, can one fix this problem? Right? Now the symmetries that extra symmetries that we need to worry about are this one form symmetry, which is a discrete one form symmetry, Z2, and the Z8 symmetry. And this mixed anomaly between Z21 and the one-form Z2 and Z8, and the mixed anomaly in the one-form Z2 and gravity. Now this is, these extra symmetries all relate to discrete unitary symmetries of the system. And we know from experience with ordinary global symmetries, the discrete unitary symmetries in 2+1 or higher dimensions, the anomalies can always be saturated by a topological quantum field theory. So given that, it's natural to then ask whether there is any topological quantum field theory which can just match these anomalies, right, of the extra anomalies associated with these discrete unitary symmetries. And so we searched for such a TQFT, and we found something very, very simple, just a Z2 gauge theory with fermionic electric charges. Such a Z2 gauge theory can exist in 3+1 dimensions, and is distinct from the bosonic one, enriched by both the Z8 and one-form symmetries in some suitable way. So then we have a candidate duality that passes the standard checks. Right? On the left-hand side, we have a strongly coupled gauge theory. On the right-hand side, we have a free Dirac theory augmented with a gap topological quantum field theory. Right? Now, both these theories this theory preserves all the global symmetries of this theory, right? It has the exact same global symmetries, and it preserves all of it. It has the exact same anomalies as this theory, right? So we can match the global symmetries, we can match the anomalies, we can match all local operators. So it's not an obviously wrong IR candidate theory. Right? It passes all the checks. It doesn't mean it's so right, because in condensed matter parlance, this could flow to a first order transition. That's always our worry, right? And indeed, Cordova, Dumitrescu discussed other candidate phases, including what I think we would just call a symmetry broken, you know, first order type transition between these two phases, right? But you can never rule that out. But this has a chance. As things stand, it seems to pass all the obvious checks. Now, if you add in the Spectator boson, then the conclusion, the Spectator boson breaks the one-form symmetry, so the loops can break, the physical loops can break. But in the TQFT that we have, the loops are fractionalized, so that even though the symmetry is broken, the topological order will survive. So then to complete the phase diagram, if this duality is right, then we get an intermediate phase which has an extra topological order. So it's a free fermion phases on both sides and a free fermion critical point, except that there's a decoupled gap topological order that sits at intermediate mass. So that's the story. And let me just stop with this thing. Sorry, I went way over time.
So how will you proceed in order to prove that this duality is indeed real?
I'm hoping that smart people like Joma and Zohar and Nati and, you know, people will find some way of evaluating whether things like this are right or not. I mean, I said we've only done simple things. How do you check any duality if you don't have supersymmetry?
No, even when you have supersymmetry, you can provide evidence evidence for it. We don't know how to prove any single one.
No, but what further evidence beyond what we've provided will you, should one check? I mean,
one thing you can check, but whether it is, that to put it on unoriented manifolds, whether it makes sense. Does that make sense
now? No, that I'm confident will make sense because we've matched the time reversal properties of both sides.
Then I think Roger has to put the thing in the computer.
Right. So I know that, I know. At the end, I said thank you for that comment because the comment I was going to make was at the end of the day, you still rely on you, Roger. You know, the only way that I know of to check this is to do numerics.
Right. There is no analytic approach to this problem, right? Otherwise.
Yeah, so once you match all the symmetries, anomalies, and what else?
But the point is that it could be that, I mean, that's a necessary condition, it's very far from sufficient. So
exactly, I know. That, so I'm well aware that it's not sufficient, but I don't know what else to check. No, I asked.
The final level is a fixed point. That would be number zero.
Right, so
that. There's a conformal field theory.
But that requires numerics.
Yes.
Right. Yep. So it requires Roger, right? But what about the question was, what am I going to do other than talk to people like Roger, right? In terms of other consistency checks that a claim duality has to pass, I don't know anything else that I can check.
Can you compare these together? Russian global symmetry, you can start beating them and see whether you can start.
Yeah.
An effort of duality that you can run on your feet every time.
No, we didn't play that game, but it's bound to work out because the response is the same on, you know, everywhere. So the only hope is that by doing that, we, as you say, land on our feet.
Yeah.
We end up with some other duality that we know, but we know of no dualities of non-supersymmetric field theories.
Maybe you write something that you
that you know is not true.
Or I would play the game. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. That's it. See if you end up with some statement that you know is false.
Yes. Okay. Right. It's easier to falsify. This is very hard to falsify.
This is very hard to falsify. That's
possible.
Yeah. So in some sense, we are in good shape. Yeah. I mean, but I have this wonderful postdoc who, real life intervenes.
These are dualities that are working 3+1. There's no epsilon expansion approach that you can use in order to do.
No, this theory is strongly coupled. So.
But so you can have epsilon expansion that is controlled and might say something. But I guess this duality doesn't survive in 3+ epsilon or 3-3 epsilon.
I don't know what to make of 3+ epsilon.
What's the upper critical dimension of the theory?
What does that even mean?
Here, you have strongly coupled theory.
Yeah.
Well, I guess the interaction term is marginal at a particular dimension. But it's just a standard way of approaching strongly coupled field theory from a perturbative way so that you can control.
Right. So what one could try to do is to go to the upper edge of the conformal window, right, and try to do perturbation theory near there. But you had exception. Since the matching of even the global symmetry, you change in a drastic way. You change a lot of different things. We did look at the massive faces for all integer and half integer values of NF. But I'm not sure what one would make out of the expansion near the edge of the conformal window. For this sort of IR statement, that may not be useful. Even for standard duality, let's say bosonic particle vortex duality, right? The epsilon expansion has never been useful. Right? When you do the epsilon expansion for that theory, the Baelin-Higgs model, you've in 4-epsilon dimensions, you find runaway flows. No one knows what to make of them. But in 3 dimensions, it's dual to the XY model. Right? So it's a second order transition. So for things like this, the epsilon expansion is probably not useful, or any such expansion in some weird limit. Right. So we need some other kind of check that directly takes the theory one has and does some weird thing, put it on some weird, I don't know, insert some weird flux, sum over those fluxes, things like that, and then see if you always get consistency or something. Right?
Just analyzing that, this is almost the same as infrared during 2+1 dimension. You have a Majorana, a massless Majorana with
half, if NF is half.
Yeah, of course,
right?
Yeah.
So
you're making a that if you take an F plus a half and you go to one dimensional.
Exactly, yeah.
Essentially,
you get this kind of that's what I said. We were inspired by that proposal to say, okay, let's just add a gap TQFT, right? And find at least the simplest TQFT that we could.
It's really a family of theories that you could theorize.
Yes.
It would be nice if you could kind of
construct
a family of theories and then.
Right. So we think by at least for NF equals 2 and NF equals 3 or NF equals 3 over 2. That we can find, we may be able to make similar statements there. We've identified the massive faces, but also we're playing around with the gauge group, right? Going from SU2 to other things. But those are, those won't directly prove or disprove. It'll just maybe make it seem more likely or whatever. I don't know what. It just gives you more examples to play with, right?
Much over time.